I think that just as we're living in a nuclear age, we have grown so tremendously in scientific knowledge, it doesn't seem too much to say that men can begin to awaken to the fact that they haven't grown enough spiritually and haven't recognized their spiritual capacities.
Once something like eating is death, then you've struck at the very heart of life. The enemy of the older radical theories may have been the ruling class, but today the stakes of whether we will reform ourselves into a new kind of human being, a new kind of society, whether we will find selves worth being, the stakes of it are simply life itself.
All right, so I'm going to read from Book 7 of Plato's Republic. This is where we find the famous allegory of the cave, and it helps explain Plato's doctrine of the forms, and it helps explain particularly the ultimate form of the good. And I'm doing this because I'm teaching a summer seminar on Plato and the early relationship between Platonic philosophy and the development of Christian theology. Let me just start. It starts at the beginning here. Next, I said, and the speaker is Socrates. Next, I said, compare the effects of education and of the lack of it on our nature to an experience like this. Okay, so he sets it up right away, telling you what this allegory is about. It's about the effect of education and the lack of it on our human nature. Okay. Imagine human beings living in an underground cave-like dwelling with an entrance a long way up, which is both open to the light and as wide as the cave itself. They've been there since childhood, fixed in the same state, with their necks in fetters and legs in fetters, able to see only in front of them because their bonds prevent them from turning their heads around. Light is provided by a fire burning far above and behind them. Also behind them, light is provided by a fire burning far above and behind them. Also behind them, but on higher ground, there is a path stretching between them and the fire. Imagine that along this path, a low wall has been built, like the screen in front of puppeteers, above which they show their puppets. I'm imagining it, and that's Glaucon. Socrates says, then also imagine that there are people along the wall carrying all kinds of artifacts that project above it, statues of people and other animals made out of stone, wood, and every material. And as you'd expect, some of the carriers are talking and some are silent. Glaucon says, it's a strange image you're describing in strange prisoners. They're like us. Do you suppose, first of all, that these prisoners see anything of themselves and one another besides the shadows that the fire casts on the wall in front of them? How could they, says Glaucon, if they have to keep their heads motionless throughout life? Well, what about the things being carried along the wall? Isn't the same true of them? Of course. And if they could talk to one another, don't you think that they'd suppose that the names they used apply to the things that they see passing before them? They'd have to. And what if their prison also had an echo from the wall facing them? Don't you think they'd believe that the shadows passing in front of them were talking whenever one of the carriers passing along the wall was doing so? I certainly do. Then the prisoners would in every way believe that the truth is nothing other than the shadows of those artifacts. They must surely believe that. Consider then what being released from their bonds and cured of their ignorance would naturally be like if something like this came to pass. When one of them was freed and suddenly compelled to stand up, turn his head, walk, and look up towards the light, he'd be pained and dazzled and unable to see the things whose shadow he'd seen before. What do you think he'd say if we told him that what he'd seen before was inconsequential? but that now, because he is a bit closer to the things that are and is turned towards things that are more, he sees more correctly. Or to put it another way, if we pointed to each of the things passing by, asked him what each of them is and compelled him to answer, don't you think he'd be at a loss? And that he'd believe that the things he saw earlier were truer than the ones he was now being shown. Much truer, says Glaucon. And if someone compelled him to look at the light itself, wouldn't his eyes hurt? And wouldn't he turn around and flee towards the things he's able to see, believing that they're really clearer than the ones he's being shown? He would. And if someone dragged him away from there by force up the rough, steep path and didn't let him go until he had dragged him into the sunlight, wouldn't he be pained and irritated at being that way? And when he came into the light with the sun filling his eyes, wouldn't he be unable to see a single one of the things now said to be true? He would be unable to see them, at least at first. I suppose, then, that he'd need time to get adjusted before he could see things in the world above. At first, he'd see the shadows most easily, then images of men and other things in water, then the things themselves. Of these, he'd be able to study the things in the sky and the sky itself more easily at night, looking at the light of the stars and the moon, than during the day, looking at the sun and the light of the sun. Of course. Finally, I suppose, he'd be able to see the sun, not images of it in water or some alien place, but the sun itself in its own place, and be able to study it. Necessarily so. And at this point, he would infer and conclude that the sun provides the seasons and the years, governs everything in the visible world, and is in some way the cause of all the things that he used to see. I'll just pause here and say, now we're beginning to see maybe the analogy, right? So now this person, because he can now see what the sun itself makes clear in front of his eyes, now begins to think also that this thing which enlightens the whole world he's looking at may also be the cause of all the things that he used to see. Okay? In other words, the cause of everything. So this is one step towards, you know, this idea of the ultimate good, which in some way is God or like God. It's clear that that would be his next step. What about when he reminds himself of his first dwelling place, his fellow prisoners, and what passed for wisdom there? Don't you think that he'd count himself happy for the change and pity the others? Certainly. And if there had been any honors, praises, or prizes among them for the one who was sharpest at identifying shadows as they passed by, and who best remembered which usually came earlier, which later, and which simultaneously, and who could thus best divine the future, do you think that our man would desire these rewards or envy those among the prisoners who were honored and held power? Instead, wouldn't he feel with Homer that he'd much prefer to, quote, work the earth as a serf to another, one without possessions, end quote, and go through any sufferings rather than share their opinions and live as they do? All right, so again, you know, once you come out of the cave, in other words, and you can see the world clearly and even contemplate the source of what you see and everything you experience, you're not going to envy people who are still caught in the cave thinking that life is shadows on a wall. And that might refer to politics or petty romantic relationships or, you know, money making or many of the other things that people prize in this world, power of all kinds, wealth, and so on. Once seeing that these are shadows on the wall, now that you're living in this other, better place, which you realize now is real, then it's more real than the world. See, that's the name of the class, right? It's more real than the world you thought you were living in. And you now are like, I would not even, you know, want to be powerful, rich, whatever these people with their petty squabbles, quarrels, and desires. So it changes you so much that you don't have any desire for that anymore, because now you're fixed upon the good itself. So Glaucon says, I suppose he would rather suffer anything than live like that. Socrates says, consider this too. If this man went down into the cave again and sat down in that same seat, wouldn't his eyes, coming suddenly out of the sun like that, be filled with darkness? Well, they certainly would. And before his eyes had recovered and the adjustment would not be quick, while his vision was still dim, if he had to compete again with the perpetual prisoners and recognizing the shadows, wouldn't he invite ridicule? Wouldn't it be said of him that he'd return from his upward journey with his eyesight ruined, and that it wasn't worthwhile even to try to travel upward? And as for anyone who tried to free him and lead, or free them and lead them upward, if they could somehow get their hands on him, wouldn't they kill him? Well, that's the position of anybody who doesn't care about those things anymore. Certainly, it was Socrates' position, and he mentions this frequently in his dialogues. The philosopher, such as himself, is considered somebody who is a babbler, a stargazer, a fool, somebody who doesn't know anything at all, somebody to despise, and so on. Meanwhile, power is given to people who are basically mental drunkards. Yes, it should remind you of the reading from week one in that regard. So Glaucon says, certainly they would. Socrates says, this whole image, Glaucon, must be fitted together with what we said before. The visible realm should be likened to the prison dwelling, and the light of the fire inside of it to the power of the sun. And if you interpret the upward journey in the study of things above as the upward journey of the soul to the intelligible realm, you'll grasp what I hope to convey, since that is what you wanted to hear about. Whether it's true or not, only the God knows. But this is how I see it. In the knowable realm, the form of the good is the last thing to be seen, and it is reached only with difficulty. Once one has seen it, however, one must conclude that it is the cause of all that is correct and beautiful in anything, that it produces both light and its source in the visible realm, and that in the intelligible realm it controls and provides truth and understanding so that anyone who is to act sensibly in private or in public must see it. Notice there that he references the God, and that happens sometimes in the dialogues. Socrates goes to the singular. Sometimes he definitely uses the plural, but sometimes he uses the singular, and he did it here when he's also talking about this concept of the good that enlightens everything, that's the source of everything. Then Socrates says, come then, share with me this thought also. It isn't surprising that the ones who get to this point are unwilling to occupy themselves with human affairs, and that their souls are always pressing upwards, eager to spend their time above. For after all, this is surely what we'd expect if indeed things fit the image I described before. It is. What about what happens when someone turns from divine study to the evils of human life? Do you think it's surprising, since his sight is still dim and he hasn't yet become accustomed to the darkness around him, that he behaves awkwardly and appears completely ridiculous if he's compelled, either in the courts or elsewhere, to contend about the shadows of justice or the statues of which they are the shadows, and to dispute about the ways these things are understood by people who have never seen justice itself? That's not surprising at all. No, it isn't. But anyone with any understanding would remember that the eyes may be confused in two ways and from two causes, namely, when they've come from the light into the darkness and when they've come from the darkness into the light, realizing that the same applies to the soul. When someone sees a soul disturbed and unable to see something, he won't laugh mindlessly, but he'll take into consideration whether it has come from a brighter life and is dimmed through not having yet become accustomed to the dark, or whether it has come from the greater ignorance into greater light and is dazzled by the increased brilliance. Then he'll declare the first soul happy in its experience in life, and he'll pity the latter But even if he chose to make fun of it, at least he'd be less ridiculous than if he laughed at a soul that had come from the light above. Okay, I think I'll leave it there. I may read more of this, I know I will use more of it in the summer seminar, but I think that gives you a pretty good idea of the content and purpose of the allegory of the cave.